from the quiet hum of the WZBC studios at Boston College on this Sunday, August 23rd, 2026. This is Arlene Russell. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, carried across the signal of Truth and Justice Radio, a place where truth does not arrive gently and where history leans forward with its full weight. Here, difficult realities are not avoided. They are met with open eyes and steady voices. Here, the past and present collide in a way that refuses to be softened or ignored. And here, we speak with Palestine living in our hearts, guiding our words, shaping our purpose, and anchoring every breath behind this microphone. Before we open this hour, let one truth stand firm in the air between us. What you hear today belongs solely to the voices speaking it, shaped by their lived experience, their research, and their refusal to soften reality. These reflections do not represent the official views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. In this space, nothing is filtered to protect comfort, and nothing is shaped to satisfy institutions. Every word arrives unshielded, unpolished, and unapologetic. And with that clarity set, we step into This Week in Palestine, a broadcast where truth does not hesitate. It does not knock politely or wait for permission. Here, truth enters with its spine straight, its voice steady, and its presence impossible to ignore. Urgency is not decoration. It is the pulse behind every sentence, every report, every breath taken at this microphone. Clarity is not a luxury. It is the obligation we accept the moment we speak. Our heart beats in Palestine, in the alleys of Jerusalem, in the villages and towns of the West Bank, in the shattered streets of Gaza. Yet our vision reaches far beyond the borders carved by occupation or diplomacy. Because the forces shaping Palestinian life do not stop at checkpoints or concrete walls. They move through parliaments, through boardrooms, through the quiet corridors where powerful hands make decisions ordinary people must live with. Wherever you are listening, driving through the long hours of your shift, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning light, or sitting in the stillness of your home, thank you for choosing to be here. I am your host and narrator, Arlene Russell. In this space, we do not file down the edges of truth. We do not bend the story to comfort those who prefer silence. We do not dilute reality for anyone's convenience. Here, truth stands unfiltered. Resistance is breath. Solidarity is lineage. And the voices rising from occupied land do not tremble. They rise beside movements across the world demanding dignity, justice, and liberation. This hour is not simply a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the deepest darkness, the spark of defiance survives. Even when the world turns away, that spark refuses to die. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, complexity, and unbroken courage. We speak with intention because the stakes demand nothing less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite silence. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. The struggle for freedom is shared. It crosses borders, and it remains sacred. Today, we confront a truth the American Empire has spent decades trying to bury. The United States did not lose its military supremacy on the battlefield. It lost it in the warehouses, the shipping lanes, the fuel depots, the supply chains, the ports, the rail lines, and the logistical arteries that keep an army alive. The collapse did not come from enemy fire. It came from within.
The myth of the invincible American military, the giant that could project power across oceans, dominate continents, and reshape nations, is suffocating under the weight of its own logistical failures. The empire is choking, not because it lacks weapons, but because it lacks the ability to move them, sustain them, and protect the systems that make war possible. The story begins with a simple, devastating idea. Military power is not measured by the number of jets or tanks. It is measured by the ability to deliver fuel, ammunition, spare parts, and food at the exact moment they are needed. And that is where America is failing. The distances of the Pacific have exposed the first crack. The United States claims it can confront China, yet it cannot guarantee fuel delivery across the ocean. Supply lines stretch too far. Ships move too slowly. Bases sit exposed to missiles and drones. In any real conflict, American forces would run out of fuel in days. The empire built its strategy on geography it can no longer overcome. Europe reveals the second crack. The U.S. insists it can defend NATO, yet its convoys struggle to move across European terrain. Bridges cannot support American armor. Roads are too narrow. Rail systems incompatible. During exercises, tanks arrived late, supplies vanished, and entire units were stranded because the logistical chain simply broke. The empire cannot move its own weight. The Middle East reveals the third crack. After 20 years of war, the U.S. military still cannot sustain itself without private contractors, local militias, and fragile political deals. America does not fight alone. It buys services from others. It rents stability. It negotiates access. It improvises. The empire cannot operate without help. Then comes the cost. America spends billions, not on weapons, but on moving them. Transportation, storage, fuel, maintenance, outsourcing, logistics devour the Pentagon's budget. The empire is drowning in inefficiency, corruption, and bureaucracy. The military machine is enormous, but its arteries are clogged. The most devastating truth emerges next. The United States cannot produce enough ammunition for a real war. Factories are outdated. Supply chains, fragile. Raw materials, imported. Production lines, slow. Ukraine exposed this weakness. America sent weapons but could not replace them fast enough. Stockpiles dropped. Production lagged. Allies panicked. The empire's industrial base, once its greatest strength, is now a relic. The Navy reveals another collapse. Ships are old, slow, and constantly breaking down. Maintenance backlogs stretch for years. Shipyards cannot keep up. The fleet looks powerful on paper, but in reality, it is a collection of aging vessels struggling to stay afloat. The Air Force reveals the same decay. Planes grounded due to lack of spare parts. Pilots unable to train because fuel is rationed. Aging aircraft requiring constant repairs. Air power, once America's pride, is now a myth held together by duct tape and nostalgia. Cyber logistics, the digital backbone of modern warfare, revealed the final vulnerability. Networks breached, systems corrupted, communications disrupted. The empire's digital infrastructure is fragile, exposed, and easily sabotaged. A single cyber attack can cripple supply lines more effectively than any missile. And then comes the most humiliating truth. America can't protect its own supply lines. Drones can strike them. Missiles can destroy them. Hackers can disrupt them. Regional powers can sabotage them. Iran demonstrated this repeatedly. Oil facilities struck, bases hit, networks disrupted. The empire's logistical weakness was exposed not by a superpower, but by a regional actor with strategic patience and asymmetric tools. Meanwhile, China built a logistical empire. Ports, railways, factories, shipping lines. While America relied on outdated systems and private contractors, China can sustain war. America cannot.
Russia built redundancy, multiple routes, domestic production, hardened infrastructure, while America built vulnerability.
Even mid-level nations like Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan have more resilient logistical systems in certain theaters.
The conclusion is unavoidable. The American military is suffocating because its logistical system is collapsing. The empire is choking. Not from lack of weapons, not from lack of soldiers, but from lack of the one thing that makes war possible: movement. The United States is a giant with broken legs, powerful arms, but unable to stand. This is not just a story about logistics. It is a story about the end of an era, a story about a superpower losing its breath, a story about a military machine that can no longer sustain itself, a story about an empire collapsing from within. And now, let's see how this story continues. Arlene Russell with you from the WZBC studios at Boston College. Welcome to This Week in Palestine, carried by Truth and Justice Radio, a broadcast where difficult truths are not avoided, but faced with unwavering resolve. This is where the long shadow of history meets the urgency of today, and neither is allowed to look away. Let's begin. So now, we bring you something extraordinary, a moment that shook Israeli television, a moment so raw and so revealing that it has already been called the conversation of the century, not by activists, not by commentators, but by Israelis themselves. Because what unfolded on that screen was not just an interview. It was a rupture, a crack in the wall of propaganda that has dominated Israeli media for years. And it came from the most unlikely place, a quiet program on the Knesset channel, far from the polished studios and the celebrity anchors who usually shape the national narrative. A 17-year-old boy, Eitan Newman, sat across from right-wing politician Moshe Feiglin, a teenager, calm and unshaken. A politician, seasoned and confident. And what happened next stunned the country. Newman pressed Feiglin with a question that Israeli journalists have avoided for decades. What happens to the Palestinians in Gaza who refuse voluntary immigration? Not the ones who leave, not the ones who are forced, the ones who stay. Feiglin tried to dance around it. He tried to soften it. He tried to hide behind slogans. But Newman didn't blink. He didn't flinch. He didn't let go. And slowly, painfully, Feiglin admitted the truth behind the euphemism. Cut off their water. Cut off their resources. Make life impossible. Force them out. And if they don't leave?
Silence. A long silence.
A silence that said more than any slogan ever could. Newman pushed again. Feiglin stumbled. Newman pressed harder. Feiglin cracked. In that moment, on live Israeli television, a teenager forced a veteran politician to reveal the real meaning behind voluntary immigration, a policy that, when stripped of its polite packaging, mirrors the darkest chapters of human history. And Israeli viewers saw it. They saw the mask fall. They saw the cruelty exposed. They saw a young interviewer do what the country's most famous journalists have refused to do for years. This wasn't on UVDA, the investigative show that claims bravery. It wasn't on Meet the Press, where conversations dissolve in a chatter. It wasn't on any of the panels filled with pundits who talk loudly and say nothing. It happened on a small, overlooked program, and it revealed more truth than the entire Israeli media establishment has dared to touch. The reaction was immediate.
shock, disbelief, a sense that something sacred had been broken open. Because Newman didn't let Feiglin hide behind rhetoric. He didn't let him blur the edges. He didn't let him escape the consequences of his own words. He exposed the lie. He exposed the policy. He exposed the worldview. And he did it with a clarity that Israel's top anchors, Yonit Levy, Danny Kushmaro, Ben Caspit, Amit Segal, Raviv Drucker, Ayala Hassan, have never dared to show. This was not just an interview. It was a reckoning. A moment when a teenager forced a politician to confront the moral weight of his own ideology and forced the nation to witness it. Now, we bring you that moment. Not to sensationalize it, not to exploit it, but because conversations like this, rare, unfiltered, unafraid, revealed the truth behind policies that shape millions of lives. This is what happened on Israeli TV. This is what was said. This is what was exposed. And this is why the world must pay attention. Again, the program is First Vote. The interviewee was Moshe Feiglin. Here's the full text. I'm going to read it to you. Newman, call it what you want. Ethnic cleansing, transfer, voluntary immigration. Fine. So I want to ask you, what will happen to the Gazan who won't want to emigrate? Will IDF soldiers pile him onto a truck and expel him? Where will they take him? What will you do to him? Feiglin, first of all, the vast majority of them want to leave, okay? Newman, I asked about those who don't want to leave. Feiglin, we need to encourage them to leave, because whoever doesn't leave will murder you. Newman, that's not what I asked. I asked, what will you do to someone you wanted to leave and doesn't leave? Feiglin, you'll make him leave. Newman, what does make mean? Feiglin, every way possible. We'll shut off his water pipes, for example. Just an example. Newman, and whoever doesn't leave can die, as far as you're concerned? Feiglin, then he'll be thirsty. He'll have to leave to drink a cup of water. Just an example. Newman, so for example, kind of kill off everyone? Silence. He didn't open his mouth. Newman? Yes? Like everyone should die? Either they go or they die? Are they not human? Feiglin, it's pretty stunning, excuse me, that after October 7th, you treat us like murderers and that Islamo-Nazi terror entity like it's under attack. Forgive me. Newman, I'm asking about your policy. I'm trying to understand what will happen if you're elected to the Knesset. Feiglin, you know, I have a grandson your age, okay? His brother lies right now beneath a grave marker because of such questions. Newman, so I'm like responsible for his killing? Is that what you're saying? Feiglin, no. I'm saying that your twisted worldview, which pursues the human rights of that murderous entity, led in the end to that disaster. Newman, so everyone should die. 2 million people will die. However many you say are there, they should die. Feiglin, I'm suggesting to you that you also listen to the person you're asking, not only to yourself. The eloquent and experienced Feiglin was shocked. He didn't expect such an interview. You don't need to expect such an interview in Israel because there are no such interviewers on television. The journalistic value is clear. The boy revealed Feiglin's true face. And more importantly, he revealed the despicable lie of voluntary immigration. No one is leaving voluntarily. It's just putting them on trucks and shipping them out. Newman didn't let him get away with evading, fudging, or blurring anything. The interviewee was forced to admit a full-blown Nazi type of solution. Let them be thirsty, he said, with a devilish cynicism and blood-chilling coldness. It isn't hard to imagine how a similar interview on the major networks would look like. Feiglin would say, voluntary emigration, and we'd move on to the next topic. Who you're going to vote for in the election? All the usual crap. Israeli interviewers do well to distinguish between what's of secondary importance and what's the main thing. They will always choose the less important item. They are afraid of asking the real questions.
Anyhow, I hope I was pronouncing his name correctly. Not sure if it's pronounced Feiglin or Feiglin.
You're hearing the voice of Arlene Russell from the WZBC studios at Boston College. Welcome to This Week in Palestine, brought to you by Truth and Justice Radio, a space where layered realities are explored with care and where the past and present meet in conversations that refuse to look away. Next, we confront a truth the American Empire has spent decades trying to bury. The United States did not lose its military supremacy in battlefields or war rooms. It lost it in the warehouses, the ports, the rail lines, the fuel depots, the supply chains, the digital networks, and the logistical arteries that keep an army alive. The collapse did not come from enemy fire. It came from within.
For generations, Washington sold the world a story that the American military was unstoppable, unmatched, invincible, a force capable of projecting power across oceans, dominating continents, and reshaping nations. But the myth is suffocating. The empire is choking on its own logistical failures, unable to sustain the very machine it built to rule the world.
The first cracks appear in the Pacific. The United States insists it can confront China, yet it cannot guarantee fuel delivery across the ocean. The distances are too vast, the supply lines too exposed, the ships too slow, the bases too vulnerable. In any real conflict, American forces would run out of fuel in days. The empire built its strategy on geography it can no longer overcome.
Europe reveals the second crack. The U.S. claims it can defend NATO, yet its convoys struggle to move across European terrain. Bridges cannot support American armor. Roads are too narrow. Rail systems incompatible. During exercises, tanks arrived late, supplies vanished, and entire units were stranded because the logistical chain simply broke. The empire cannot move its own weight.
The Middle East reveals the third crack. After 20 years of war, the U.S. military still cannot sustain itself without private contractors, local militias, and fragile political deals. America does not fight alone. It buys services from others. It rents stability. It negotiates access. It improvises. The empire cannot operate without help.
Then comes the cost. America spends billions, not on weapons, but on moving them. Transportation, storage, fuel, maintenance, outsourcing. Logistics devour the Pentagon's budget. The military machine is enormous, but its arteries are clogged. Efficiency became a liability. Outsourcing became dependence. Bureaucracy became paralysis.
The most devastating truth emerges next. The United States cannot produce enough ammunition for a real war. Factories are outdated, supply chains fragile, raw materials imported, production lines slow. Ukraine exposed this weakness. America sent weapons but could not replace them fast enough. Stockpiles dropped, production lagged, allies panicked. The empire's industrial base, once its greatest strength, is now a relic.
The Navy reveals another collapse. Ships are old, slow, and constantly breaking down. Maintenance backlogs stretch for years. Shipyards cannot keep up. The fleet looks powerful on paper, but in reality, it is a collection of aging vessels struggling to stay afloat.
The Air Force reveals the same decay. Planes grounded due to lack of spare parts. Pilots unable to train because fuel is rationed. Aging aircraft requiring constant repairs. Air power, once America's pride, is now a myth held together by duct tape and nostalgia.
What about the cyber logistics, the digital backbone of modern warfare? Reveal the final vulnerability. Networks breached, systems corrupted, communications disrupted. The empire's digital infrastructure is fragile, exposed, and easily sabotaged. A single cyber attack can cripple supply lines more effectively than any missile. And then comes the most humiliating truth. America cannot protect its own supply lines. Drones can strike them. Missiles can destroy them. Hackers can disrupt them. Regional powers can sabotage them. Iran demonstrated this repeatedly. Oil facilities struck. Bases hit. Networks disrupted. The empire's logistical weakness was exposed not by a superpower, but by a regional actor with strategic patience and asymmetric tools. Meanwhile, China built a logistical empire, ports, railways, factories, shipping lines, while America relied on outdated systems and private contractors. China can sustain war. America cannot. Russia built redundancy, multiple routes, domestic production, hardened infrastructure, while America built vulnerability. Even mid-level nations like Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan have more resilient logistical systems in certain theaters. The conclusion is unavoidable. The American military is suffocating because its logistical system is collapsing. The empire is choking. Not from lack of weapons, not from lack of soldiers, but from lack of the one thing that makes war possible: movement. The United States is a giant with broken legs, powerful arms, but unable to stand. This is not just a story about logistics. It is a story about the end of an era, a story about a superpower losing its breath, a story about a military machine that can no longer sustain itself, a story about an empire collapsing from within. And now, this story stands ready for anyone who reads it. Today, tomorrow, or years from now. Because the collapse of logistical power is not a moment. It is a trajectory. It is a warning. It is the quiet suffocation of a nation that once believed it could never fall. If we look closely, we realize something far more painful. We are all paying the price for one man's reckless decision to open the Strait of Hormuz, a strait that was never closed to begin with. A decision built on ego, not strategy. A decision that turned a stable waterway into a stage for chaos. A decision that dragged nations into danger for the sake of a headline. And now the bill has arrived. Not for him, but for all of us. Arlene Russell reporting from the WZBC studios at Boston College. This is This Week in Palestine, carried by Truth and Justice Radio, the broadcast that doesn't flinch from complexity, that pushes into the hard questions, and where the echoes of history collide with the pressure of the present. Okay, now why Turkey terrifies Israel? Another thing, did Trump arms Ankara and the region braces for what comes next? Today, we step into a moment where the balance of power in the Middle East is shifting so quickly, so dramatically, that even the most confident actors are beginning to tremble. The rise of Turkey's military power, long underestimated, long dismissed, long misunderstood, is now forcing Israel to confront a reality it never imagined, a regional rival capable of challenging its dominance. The transformation did not happen overnight. It happened through years of investment, strategy, ambition, and a clear vision of national strength. Turkey rebuilt its military from the ground up, modernizing its air force, expanding its drone capabilities, strengthening its naval presence, and developing domestic weapon systems that no longer rely on foreign suppliers. The country that once depended on NATO hand-me-downs now produces advanced drones, missile systems, armored vehicles, and electronic warfare platforms that rival the world's top manufacturers. Israel sees this. Israel feels this. Israel fears this. The anxiety grows sharper as Turkey's rhetoric intensifies.
Ankara speaks openly about regional justice, about defending Muslim populations, about confronting oppression, about reshaping the political map of the Middle East. Israel hears every word. Israel reads every signal. Israel watches every military exercise with growing concern.
And then comes the shock. Trump arms Turkey.
The decision reverberates across the region. Trump, who once positioned himself as Israel's strongest ally, now opens the door for Ankara to acquire advanced American weapons, weapons that could tilt the balance of power, weapons that could challenge Israel's air superiority, weapons that could redefine the strategic landscape. The move is not symbolic. It is structural. It is geopolitical. It is a message that Washington's alliances are shifting, that Israel's privileged position is eroding, that Turkey is rising as a central pillar of American strategy.
Israel interprets this as betrayal. Turkey interprets it as validation. The region interprets it as a warning. Now the question emerges, is confrontation inevitable? Turkey's military posture grows more assertive. Its drones dominate battlefields from Libya to Azerbaijan. Its naval forces expand their reach across the Mediterranean. Its intelligence networks operate with precision. Its political influence stretches from the Balkans to the Gulf. Israel, once confident in its regional superiority, now faces a rival with ambition, capability, and global backing. The fear is not just about weapons. It is about ideology. It is about momentum. It is about a nation that believes it has a mission. Turkey's leadership speaks of justice for Gaza. Israel hears threat. Turkey speaks of regional balance. Israel hears challenge. Turkey speaks of sovereignty. Israel hears confrontation. The tension grows as both nations maneuver diplomatically. Israel attempts to rally Western support, highlighting Turkey's alliances, its rhetoric, its regional ambitions. Turkey counters by presenting itself as a stabilizing force, a defender of regional rights, a nation capable of confronting injustice where others remain silent. Trump's decision to arm Ankara becomes the catalyst. It signals that Washington is no longer willing to let Israel dictate the region's military hierarchy. It signals that Turkey's role is expanding. It signals that the old order is collapsing. The possibility of confrontation is no longer theoretical. It is whispered in diplomatic circles. It is analyzed in military briefings. It is discussed in intelligence reports. It is felt in every shift of regional alliances. Turkey's rise terrifies Israel, not because of what Turkey has done, but because of what Turkey is becoming. A nation with a powerful military, a nation with a clear mission, a nation with global backing, a nation with regional influence, a nation that refuses to bow. Israel's fear is rooted in history. For decades, it operated as the region's dominant military force, confident that no neighboring country could challenge its air superiority, its intelligence capabilities, or its technological edge. Turkey disrupts that certainty. Turkey introduces unpredictability. Turkey introduces competition. The region watches closely. Saudi Arabia recalibrates. Qatar strengthens ties. Iran observes with interest. Egypt weighs its options. Europe monitors the shift. Russia and China see opportunity. The Middle East is entering a new era, an era where Turkey's military power reshapes alliances, where Israel faces a rival it cannot ignore, where American decisions accelerate regional transformation, where confrontation becomes a possibility that no one can dismiss. This is not just a story about weapons. It is a story about fear, a story about ambition, a story about shifting power, a story about a region rewriting its future. Turkey terrifies Israel, not because of what it has done, but because of what it is preparing to do, and because the world is beginning to accept that Turkey's rise is not temporary, not accidental, not reversible.
The confrontation may not erupt today. It may not erupt tomorrow. But the trajectory is clear. The pressure is building. The alliances are shifting. The weapons are moving. The rhetoric is intensifying. The fear is growing.
And now, this story stands ready for anyone who reads it, today, tomorrow, or years from now. Because the rise of Turkey and the anxiety of Israel are not moments. They are movements. They are forces. They are the new reality of a region that refuses to remain silent, refuses to remain static, refuses to remain under the shadow of old powers.
The question is no longer whether the confrontation will erupt. The question is how long the region can hold its breath.
Me, myself, I don't think for long. The confrontation is coming sooner or later, especially with the way Israel treats the region. But, yes, I said but, can Israel go face to face with Turkey? Let's take a look at Turkey versus Israel, a detailed comparison of two armies on a collision course.
Now we examine two militaries whose trajectories are reshaping the Middle East, the Turkish Armed Forces and the Israeli Defense Forces. Their rivalry is not declared, but it is felt. Their doctrines differ, but their ambitions collide. Their strengths are distinct, but their weaknesses reveal the future of regional power.
This is not a superficial comparison. This is a deep, structural, strategic examination of two armies preparing for a world that is changing faster than their alliances.
And the truth is simple. Turkey and Israel are powerful in different ways, and those differences matter.
Turkey begins with scale, a nation of more than 84 million people, with a military that reflects the size of its geography and the weight of its ambitions. Israel begins with a nation of 9 million, mostly immigrated from the West. And yes, it's true, the military built on technology, speed, and deterrence. One relies on mass, the other relies on edge.
Turkey fields nearly 500,000 active soldiers, supported by hundreds of thousands of reserves, and a paramilitary force that expands its reach across borders. Israel fields 169,500 active troops, backed by a large reserve system designed for rapid mobilization. Turkey's manpower is overwhelming. Israel's manpower is efficient.
Turkey's defense budget surpasses $51 billion, fueled by a trillion-dollar economy. Israel spends $34 billion, but dedicates a far larger share of its GDP to defense. Turkey spends broadly. Israel spends intensely.
The air is where the comparison becomes dramatic. Turkey commands more than 1,000 aircraft, including nearly 300 combat jets, and a helicopter fleet that dwarfs Israel's. Israel, however, holds the advantage in fighter quality. Its fleet of 239 advanced fighters, including F-35s, gives it a technological edge Turkey cannot match. Israel also maintains more aerial refueling tankers, extending its reach far beyond its borders. Turkey dominates the sky in numbers. Israel dominates the sky in capability.
On the ground, Turkey's advantage is undeniable. More than 2,200 tanks, thousands of armored vehicles, and a land force designed for sustained operations across multiple theaters. Israel's 1,300 tanks, though fewer, are among the most advanced in the world, the Merkava series, built for survivability and precision.
At sea, the contrast becomes even sharper. Turkey's navy is one of the largest in the region, with 195 vessels, including 13 submarines and a growing fleet of corvettes and amphibious ships. Israel's navy, with 52 vessels and 6 submarines, is smaller but technologically refined. Turkey commands the Mediterranean with presence. Israel commands it with specialization. Then comes the factor that changes everything, nuclear capability. Israel possesses an estimated 90 nuclear warheads, an undeclared but widely acknowledged deterrent that shapes every strategic calculation in the region. Turkey has none. This single difference creates a psychological and political imbalance that no number of tanks or ships can erase. But when we step back and look at the larger picture,
the imbalance becomes far more complicated.
Turkey is part of NATO, which means any nuclear strike against Turkey is treated as a strike against the entire alliance. That protection alone changes the equation. And now, Turkey is also tied into the Mecca Pact, standing alongside Pakistan, a nation that does possess nuclear warheads, and Saudi Arabia, a nation that holds the money, the energy leverage, and the political weight of the Gulf.
In other words, Turkey may not own nuclear weapons, but it is surrounded by allies who do, and protected by an alliance that cannot afford to let it fall.
But military power is not only measured in weapons, it is measured in industry. Turkey has built a defense sector capable of producing drones, armored vehicles, naval ships, missile systems, and electronic warfare platforms. Its drones have changed wars from Libya to Azerbaijan. Its shipyards are expanding. Its factories are multiplying. Israel's industry, smaller but sharper, produces some of the world's most advanced air defense systems, cyber tools, avionics, and precision weapons.
Doctrine reveals the soul of each army. Israel follows the principle of maintaining a qualitative military edge, striking first, striking fast, and striking with overwhelming precision. Its military is built for short, decisive operations.
Turkey follows the doctrine of regional projection, expanding influence through presence, bases, and sustained operations. Its military is built for endurance.
Geography shapes their strategies. Israel is small, surrounded, and dependent on speed. Turkey is vast, positioned at the crossroads of continents, and capable of absorbing conflict. Israel fights to survive. Turkey fights to expand.
Technology shapes their future. Israel leads in cyber warfare, missile defense, and advanced avionics. Turkey leads in drone warfare, naval expansion, and mass production. Israel's strength is in innovation. Turkey's strength is in transformation.
And then comes the question that hangs over the region. Which army is stronger?
The answer depends on the battlefield. In a conventional war of scale, Turkey holds the advantage. More soldiers, more ships, more tanks, more aircraft, more geography, more industrial capacity. In a high-tech war of precision, Israel holds the advantage. Better fighters, better defenses, better cyber tools, better intelligence, and nuclear deterrence.
Turkey is the stronger conventional force.
Israel depends on the USA.
Turkey can overwhelm. Israel depends on the USA.
Turkey can sustain. Israel depends on the USA.
Turkey can project. Israel depends on the USA.
Both armies are powerful, but powerful in different ways. One that built itself, and one that depends on the USA.
This comparison is not just numbers. It is a map of the future. A future where scale meets sophistication. A future where ambition meets deterrence. A future where Turkey and Israel define the next chapter of regional power. And we all can see where this is going.
From the quiet glow of the WZBC studio at Boston College, this is Arlene Russell. You're tuned to This Week in Palestine, carried across the airwaves by Truth and Justice Radio, a place where complexity breathes, where history whispers through every segment, and where the urgency of today rises to meet it.
Okay, so now we step into a story that has been hiding in plain sight. A story whispered in diplomatic corridors, buried in intelligence briefings, and ignored by governments that fear what it might reveal. A story that reshapes alliances, exposes vulnerabilities, and reveals how Iran has woven itself into the fabric of global power without firing a single shot.
This is the Iran connection no one is talking about. Not because it is invisible, but because acknowledging it would force the world to confront a truth it has avoided for decades.
Iran's influence is not built on armies marching across borders. It is built on networks, leverage, patience, and the quiet ability to make powerful nations move without ever appearing to push them. Iran has mastered the art of indirect power, and today, that power is reshaping the Middle East, the Gulf, Europe, and even the United States.
The story begins with energy. Iran sits at the crossroads of oil routes, gas pipelines, and maritime choke points that determine the fate of global markets. The Strait of Hormuz, the artery of world energy, is not controlled by America, not controlled by the Gulf, but controlled by Iran's ability to disrupt it at will. The world pretends this is not true, but every tanker that passes through those waters does so under Iran's shadow. Then comes the second layer. Alliances built not through treaties, but through necessity. Gulf nations, once confident in American protection, now find themselves recalibrating. Saudi Arabia negotiates quietly. Qatar balances carefully. The UAE, once bold, now moves cautiously, seeking to avoid becoming the next target of Iranian retaliation. Iran does not need to dominate the Gulf. It only needs the Gulf to fear instability, and that fear gives Iran leverage. Now we move to the third layer, Iran's regional network. Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, each a node in a web of influence that stretches across borders. These are not proxies in the traditional sense. They are pressure points. They are bargaining chips. They are strategic assets that allow Iran to shape outcomes far beyond its borders. When Iran wants to send a message, it does not need to speak. It simply allows one of its allies to act. The fourth layer is the most surprising: Iran's quiet connections to global powers. China invests in Iranian infrastructure. Russia coordinates military strategy. Turkey negotiates energy routes. Pakistan shares intelligence. These relationships are not alliances. They are transactions, each one giving Iran a new form of leverage. Iran has positioned itself as a necessary partner for nations that seek independence from Western pressure. And then comes the layer no one wants to discuss: Iran's influence inside the United States. Not through espionage or infiltration, but through the consequences of American decisions. Every miscalculation in Washington strengthens Iran. Every failed intervention empowers Iran. Every collapsed alliance opens a door for Iran. The United States, without realizing it, has become one of the architects of Iran's rise. Iran's connection to global power is not built on strength alone. It is built on the weaknesses of others. The Gulf's dependence on stability, Europe's dependence on energy, Russia's dependence on regional leverage, China's dependence on trade routes, America's dependence on predictable allies. Iran understands these dependencies better than anyone, and it uses them with precision. Now we reach the part of the story that reveals the depth of Iran's strategy, the economic web. Iran has built financial channels that bypass sanctions, using Gulf banks, Asian markets, African ports, and digital currencies to move money quietly across continents. Nations that publicly condemn Iran privately rely on its networks. Iran's economy is not isolated. It is embedded. The next layer is technological. Iran's cyber capabilities, once dismissed, now rival those of major powers. Its hackers have penetrated banks, oil companies, government networks, and military systems. Iran does not need to strike physically. It can strike digitally, and every nation knows it. Then comes the military layer. Not the size of Iran's army, but the reach of its missiles, drones, and asymmetric tools. Iran has built weapons designed not to win wars, but to make wars too costly for its enemies. Every drone that flies over a Gulf facility, every missile that lands near an American base, every cyber attack that disrupts a network sends the same message: Iran can hurt you without fighting you. This is the connection no one wants to acknowledge. Iran has become a central player in global stability, not because it is loved, not because it is feared, but because it is unavoidable.
And now we reach the final layer, the one that explains why this story matters today.
Iran's rise is not the result of aggression. It is the result of patience. While other nations rushed into wars, Iran waited. While others spent billions on interventions, Iran invested in networks. While others relied on alliances, Iran relied on leverage. While others tried to dominate, Iran tried to endure.
The world is beginning to understand that Iran's power is not temporary. It is structural. It is embedded in energy routes, political networks, military balances, and economic systems. It is embedded in the fears of its enemies and the needs of its partners. It is embedded in the mistakes of global powers and the shifting alliances of the Middle East. This is the Iran connection no one is talking about, not because it is hidden, but because it is uncomfortable. It forces nations to confront the reality that Iran is not a problem to be solved. It is a force to be reckoned with, a player that cannot be ignored, a nation that has shaped the region more through restraint than through war. And now, this story stands ready for anyone who reads it, today, tomorrow, or years from now, because Iran's rise is not a moment, it is a movement. It is a recalibration of global power. It is the quiet transformation of a nation that learned how to turn pressure into influence, isolation into leverage, and survival into strategy. The Iran connection is real, it is powerful, and it is reshaping the world in ways no one can afford to ignore. Arlene Russell here, speaking from the heart of the WZBC studios at Boston College. This is This Week in Palestine, carried across the airwaves of Truth and Justice Radio, a space where hard truths are met head-on without apology. Here, the weight of history does not sit quietly. It presses into the present with force, demanding to be acknowledged. And in this hour, we answer that demand. I was listening earlier to Olivia Swing. She is sharp, unfiltered, and relentless in her pursuit of truth. Olivia does not tiptoe around sensitive subjects. She walks straight into them. Her delivery is calm, but her words cut with surgical precision. She has built a reputation for exposing the narratives that governments, media institutions, and lobby networks work tirelessly to protect. She does not shout. She does not dramatize. She reveals. She names what others avoid. And in her YouTube episode, she turns her attention to one of the most protected subjects in Western political discourse, the cult surrounding Israel. Now let's talk about the content of her video, so you will know exactly what you will hear when you listen to her. Olivia dismantles a political phenomenon that has quietly shaped American politics for decades. She explains how Israel has become a dividing line inside the American right, a fault line splitting the MAGA movement into two camps, those who prioritize Israel above all else and those who insist on putting America first. She shows how this fracture is not theoretical. It is happening in real time. Trump unendorsing Marjorie Taylor Greene. Candace Owens fired from the Daily Wire. Tucker Carlson labeled anti-Semitic for questioning foreign policy. Millions of voters suddenly asking, when did America first become Israel first? Olivia goes deeper, exposing the machinery behind this divide. She explains why Israel receives more U.S. aid than any other country and what that money could have done inside the United States instead. She breaks down the influence of Christian Zionism, tracing it back to the Scofield Reference Bible and the way dispensationalist theology reshaped American evangelical culture. She shows how political Zionism became entangled with biblical prophecy, creating a belief system where supporting Israel is treated as a religious obligation rather than a policy choice. She then reveals the financial engine behind the cult, mega donors like Miriam Adelson, who pour hundreds of millions of dollars into American politics to ensure Israel remains untouchable.
she highlights Netanyahu's 58 standing ovations in Congress, a symbol of how deeply this loyalty is embedded in Washington. She points out how questioning Israeli policy is often reframed as anti-Semitism, even when the criticism is grounded in documented facts.
Olivia's analysis is not anti-Semitic. It is anti-blindness. She makes it clear that understanding this cult is essential to understanding why American foreign policy looks the way it does, and why the right is tearing itself apart over a country thousands of miles away. She speaks directly to viewers who feel confused, silenced, or dismissed for asking basic questions about where their tax dollars go and why their political leaders prioritize foreign interests over domestic needs.
Her message is simple. This isn't about being pro-Israel or anti-Israel. This is about understanding the power structures that shape American politics and the consequences of never questioning them. And now, with the truth laid bare, I invite you to look up her YouTube and listen to it. It's called The Cult Around Israel No One Wants to Talk About.
And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The lantern lowering its glow, the truth settling into the room after an hour that demanded courage, clarity, and an open heart. As you step back into your day, may the questions that surfaced here refuse to be buried. May the courage stirred within you refuse to fade. And may the curiosity that keeps truth alive continue to burn in a world that works tirelessly to smother it. I'm Arlene Russell, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour rooted in dignity, in clarity, and in a solidarity that does not evaporate when headlines shift or when cameras turn away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or cracked open a door you didn't know existed, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is living proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radioforall.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on KKRN 88.5 FM, community radio in Shasta County, California, streaming at kkrn.org anywhere. You can catch the show every Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Spread the word. Tell your friends. Let the signal travel. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care, stay grounded, stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is Occupied Land. This is Palestine, and the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine, from the river to the sea. Palestine, Hurra.
My national aspirations, you respect them, do you? I see. Well, the way you would respect them is by getting out of my land. That would be the best illustration of how much you respect my national aspirations. I find you fascinating, Mr. Dayan. I really do. I can't understand how you have such self-assurance. A man who was born in Argentina, whose family comes from the Ukraine, and is actually wanting people, sensible people, to believe that he has some connection with my country. But there's another point I want to put to you, since you respect me so much. Tell me, to many people, you, despite your eloquence, represent nothing other, you and your fellow settlers, nothing other than common thieves. You live on stolen land, you drink stolen water, you eat stolen fruit, you farm stolen farms. Convince me, and the audience, and the viewers, that you are not, you and your settler friends, are not common thieves.